My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Welcome to episode 50 of My Classic Album, the show that looks back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and I've been looking forward to this day for a long time, to get to 50 episodes of My Classic Album, having looked back at 50 phenomenal albums over what's been nearly 5 years altogether since we started back in 2016. And there's so much coming up on today's show. As a thank you to everyone who's been listening, as a thank you to anyone who has supported My Classic Album, just to get that opportunity to celebrate 50 episodes. A lot of work goes into this podcast, and it seemed like a worthy milestone to get excited about. So there's some great stuff coming up today, kind of top of the pile, headliner if you like. Ian Haugland from Europe is joining me to chat about his chosen classic album, Rising by Rainbow. A great conversation about an album that really paved the way for a lot of hard rock and metal that was to come after its release. A great chat with Ian. You know, Europe, absolutely one of my favourite bands growing up. Huge fan of the band. I had a copy, it was like a greatest hits called Super Hits. And it had just some absolutely awesome Europe tracks on there. And I was lucky enough to see them live in 2011. Followed the band for a long time. So the opportunity to chat with Ian about his chosen classic album was a treat that I couldn't pass up, and more than worthy of our conversation here on the 50th episode of My Classic Album. So, you know, really, really looking forward to y'all hearing that. That's, of course, going to be the meat and potatoes of today. That's going to be the main focus of today's episode. But there's some other cool stuff coming up too. Not least the reveal of something we've been doing on our social media channels for around a month now. Again, to celebrate 50 episodes of My Classic Album, we have been trying to discover which of those 50 albums is your classic album, the listeners of the podcast. So it's been a lot of fun. It's taken off a lot more than I thought it would too. It's been fantastic to do. So basically, for anyone who's not in the know, over our Instagram story, so our Instagram page, you can follow us at My Classic Album Podcast. And what we've been doing over there on the Instagram stories is putting up polls every day, picking up some of the albums that we've done over the last 5 years against each other in a 50 album tournament. And that started on the 18th of May. Every single album, including Rising, has been involved in that tournament. And we've just broke it down. So 24 hours to vote, whichever one was ahead at the close of play. So it was 9 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time that a new poll started and the old one ended. 9 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time was the point where we knew who was going through. And on the 12th of June, so just a few days ago, we had our grand final. So it's been really exciting just to see which albums you enjoy, see which albums we're going to go through each day. And I know there's been some huge shocks along the way. I know that Dio's Holy Diver did really, really well. And it's a phenomenal album, and so it should have done. But knocking out the likes of Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf, Blue by Joni Mitchell, Animals by Pink Floyd. So it's an album, it made it all the way to the quarterfinals, which was just great. Stuff like that, seeing which albums you enjoyed. It's clear that people listening to My Classic Album have very similar tastes to me, that kind of hard rock metal stuff. Again, really excited to reveal the winner of the 50 album showdown towards the end of the show. Another mystery will be solved towards the end of the show as well, and I'm very excited about this one. So anyone, again, knowing those social media channels, and just for anyone who doesn't, let's get them out of the way. So I've already talked about Instagram. That's at My Classic Album Podcast. You can also like us on Facebook, so My Classic Album with Mike Norris, or you can follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. And of course, keeping up with the show on myclassicalbum.co.uk. Those channels are the first place where I reveal upcoming guests for My Classic Album. That is usually the case anyway. Episode 50 is a little bit different. It's a little bit special. So I'm going to be announcing our special guest for episode 52. So this episode will be going out on the 15th of July. In between that, there'll be an appearance from Jonathan Antoine, classically trained tenor, Britain's Got Talent finalist, who's chosen Jeff Buckley's Grace as his classic album. You can hear that in a couple of weeks. Great conversation. But on the 15th of July, so 4 weeks from today, we have a very, very special guest on the show. And I'm not exaggerating here, I'm not bullshitting when I say that this is one of my musical heroes from one of my favourite bands of all time. Absolutely astonished that we managed to get this guy on the show. I nearly said his name there. Absolutely astonished that we managed to get him. Rather than announce that on social media, as I usually do, I decided I was going to have a bit of fun. And I put a few clues up there. I've kept it a mystery. I've revealed the classic album that he's chosen, but I still haven't revealed the guest. And I'm going to be doing that today, again, towards the back end of the show. So lots of stuff to enjoy after my chat with Ian Haugland from Europe. Just a couple of clues to whet your appetite. I left these on social media. Anyone who hasn't seen them, again, a couple of clues just to whet your appetite about this special guest. And just to show you that it does kind of fit up to the surprise and the billing. And, you know, I'm like to think that I'm not overselling this. I really don't think that I am. So this guy, the band that he's in, have sold over 100 million albums across their career. They're one of only five rock bands in music history to achieve two Diamond Certified albums across their career. And they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So we're talking heavyweight here, really huge, huge guest star. And he's chosen an amazing album in Aladdin Sane as well. I was going to put the clue as well that we've done one of their albums on My Classic Album, which is totally true. We have. It's one of my favourite episodes that we've done. But what I soon found out was that all five of those rock bands that have had at least two Diamond albums in America, we have covered at least one of their albums. So that doesn't particularly narrow it down. So, while you're Googling frantically and trying to work out which of those bands it could be and trying to work that out, I'm just going to carry on with the show. And then what we'll do towards the end, I will reveal who that guest is going to be in 4 weeks' time. And I hope it lives up to the hype. I mean, it does. It does live up to the hype. So, keep listening for that. Fantastic. So excited. We've talked about some amazing musical legends over the years on My Classic Album. The likes of Freddie Mercury, John Lennon, Aretha Franklin, David Gilmour, to name just a few. Someone that we haven't touched on yet, and we're going to rectify that now, we're going to sort that out, is Andy Dwyer. Now, obviously, Andy is a prolific, a really important part of the music scene in Pawnee, Indiana, performing in bands such as Fleetwood Mac, Sex Pants, Just the Tip, and of course, Razor Dick. But it is, in fact, Mouse Rat, for which Andy is most well known. And 10 years ago, Mouse Rat performed a seminal show that rivals Queen's performance at Live Aid, Nirvana's Unplugged session, the day that Dylan went electric, when they performed at the funeral of Pawnee Town mascot Lil Sebastian. At that show, Mouse Rat performed the iconic song 5,000 Candles in the Wind, and to commemorate 10 years since Lil Sebastian's passing, just last month, the song was released on all streaming platforms, and there was a huge, huge reception and appetite for more from Mouse Rat. Well, I can announce here on My Classic Album, really excited to do so, that Mouse Rat will finally be releasing their album, The Awesome Album, later this year. It's about time. I think it's kind of up there with Chinese Democracy in terms of some of the most anticipated albums in the world. And I think, yeah, it's a privilege for me to be able to play the song that arguably moved all of this and kind of shifted this into some kind of motion. So absolutely, really absolutely thrilled, quite emotional to be able to play for you today that very track that we've been talking about. So this is Mouse Rat with 5,000 Candles in the Wind.
Up in horsey heaven, here's a thing. You trade your legs for angels' wings. Once we've all said goodbye, you take a run and leap and you learn to fly. Bye, bye, little Sebastian. Miss you in the saddest fashion. Bye, bye, little Sebastian. You're 5,000 candles. There in heaven's hay, but here's the part that hurts the most. Humans cannot ride a ghost. Bye, bye, little Sebastian. Miss you in the saddest fashion. Someday we'll saddle up again, and I know I'll always miss my horsiest friend. Spread your wings and fly, spread your wings and fly.
So I imagine there's probably a bit of confusion from some of you thinking, what just happened? But then I think there's probably just as many who are quite excited and find it hilarious what just happened. So anyone who's seen the TV show Parks and Recreation will hopefully have got that reference. So Parks and Recreation is an awesome TV show out of America. If you like things like The Office, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I'd thoroughly recommend that you check it out. And Mouse Rat are a band who perform in the show. Andy Dwyer is played by Chris Pratt, who you'll all know from the Marvel movies, as Star-Lord, Jurassic World. Obviously, he's one of the biggest movie stars in the world at this point. I think arguably Parks and Rec was his kind of breakthrough role, if you like. And I'm not lying when I say that Mouse Rat are releasing an album. They genuinely are. So Mouse Rat's album, The Awesome Album, is out on the 27th of August on vinyl, CD, and cassette. I've actually already pre-ordered mine on vinyl because I love the show. And loads of the songs that you'll know from the show. So 5,000 Candles in the Wind, of course. The Pit, Sex Hair, all these songs that Andy sings on the show are there on the album. So, you know, absolute, just a bit of fun to be able to play a song from that. I was really pleased when they said that I could. But absolutely, if you want to pre-order that, you can pre-order that from Jewel Tone's website. The album's been released in partnership with Jewel Tone and Entertainment 720. So get yourself to jeweltonestore.com, and there's loads of like CD, I believe there's cassette and vinyl editions of the album, and the coloured vinyl as well. You all know I'm a sucker for coloured vinyl. I've ordered mine in Cherry Gurgitch, which again, any fans of the show will hopefully get that reference. But, you know, absolutely get it pre-ordered. Just a bit of fun, absolutely. But, you know, I hope that people enjoyed that performance of 5,000 Candles in the Wind. And I hope you didn't mind me having a little bit of fun there, kind of before we dive into the episode today. But let's get down to business. My special guest today, talking about the phenomenal album Rising by Rainbow, is Europe drummer Ian Haugland. Before we get to my chat with Ian all about this amazing album, let's, as always, let's just look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Rising. Rising is the second studio album from Anglo-American rock band Rainbow. Led by guitarist Richie Blackmore and vocalist Ronnie James Dio, the pair replaced the rest of the Rainbow lineup that appeared on the band's first album and set up at Musicland Studios in Munich, Germany to record what would become Rising. Produced by Martin Birch, Rising saw its release on the 15th of May 1976 and quickly solidified Rainbow as a formidable hard rock act. Only Starstruck was chosen to be released from the album, but ultimately didn't make a splash on any music charts. However, songs on Rising carried significant influence as the years progressed. Stargazer in particular, which opened up Rising's second half, has been cited as an integral part of the development of fantasy imagery in heavy metal, and has long been deemed a highlight in Ronnie James Dio's illustrious career. The album proved to be a success for Rainbow, charting at number 48 on the US Billboard 200 and just missing out on the top 10 in the UK, reaching number 11. Rising also fared well in Canada, Australia and Sweden. The album's performance in the UK was enough for it to certify gold in 1979, with a deluxe edition released in 2011, certifying silver just 2 years later. Rising has been seen as a landmark album, and like Stargazer, its influence on the lyrical and musical themes of heavy metal are well established. Classic Rock magazine named the album 18th in its 100 Greatest Rock Albums Ever in 2006. However, most notably, in 1981, the then new publication Kerrang! Named Rising the greatest heavy metal album of all time. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Rising, and I have here with me my very special guest who chose the album to talk about on our 50th episode of My Classic Album. This is Ian Haugland from Europe. How's it going?
Hey, Mike, how are you? Everything is just going fine here. How is everything with you?
Yeah, fantastic. You know, obviously really excited we're celebrating our 50th episode, and obviously getting you on to do it as well is a great thrill for me personally. So thanks very much for joining us.
That's amazing. Yeah, cool.
Just to kind of get started, you know, why have you chosen Rising specifically to talk about on My Classic Album today?
I think I could go as far as saying that Rainbow Rising is the reason why I started playing music in the first place. It's the milestone. It's the holy grail. It was kind of the eye opener, and I was like baptized by rock and roll. When I heard that album, it's almost like a sacred thing for me. It's so definite. So it's like there's no doubt whatsoever. This is the album, you know.
And I think in that sense, I think it is very much a landmark album. I'm sure we'll talk about that. The perfect kind of album to talk about for our 50th episode. What are your memories of hearing this album for the first time?
Well, my first memory, actually, I have to go back a year in time before Rainbow Rising, because it was my classmate. He had the first Rainbow album. He got it as a Christmas gift from his parents, and so he said to me one day at school, like, have you heard this band Rainbow? You just have to listen to it, it's so great. So we went back to his place, and I heard the opening riff of Man on the Silver Mountain, and then immediately Ronnie James Dio's voice, and I was like, wow, this is something just popped out of the speakers and grabbed hold of my heart and my soul. You know, it was like I was captured, but still I wasn't totally 100%, you know, overwhelmed. I really liked it and everything. But then I went to the local record store one day, and I saw this. I remember I stepped into the shop. And they had like a rack with the vinyls, the new releases and everything. And there it was. I mean, that record sleeve, Ken Kelly's artwork, it was basically, yeah, it hit me in the face like the fist that comes out of the that comes out of the lake and grabbing the rainbow. You know, it was just shining there on the record rack. It stood out. And so I just went up to it, and I realized that this was the same band as Man on the Silver Mountain. So I just grabbed it, and I asked the record dealer if I could listen to it, and he had like a vinyl player in the store. So I put on the headphones, and man, that was something else, you know, with Tarot Woman when it started off with a keyboard solo, and I was just like, it was like being dragged into like a mystical world of sorts that you never heard about or never experienced before. So it was from the first second, I was just like totally mesmerized by it. Yeah.
As we've already said, many point to this album as this hugely influential, like a landmark album in the development of hard rock and metal. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that this album, and Rainbow in particular, why do you think they're lauded in this way? What is it about the album that makes it such a such a landmark?
I don't know. It's just perfect. It's a perfect hard rock metal album, you know, with that artwork and with a only six songs. It's not too much and it's not too little. You know, once the last chord dies out on a Light in the Black, you have the whole buffet. So it's so, I don't know. And it has everything. It has the artwork. It has the stylistics. It felt like I was holding a nugget of gold in my hand when I got that album. You couldn't ask for any more. It was just perfect. And I mean, I think also that both Richie Blackmore and Ronnie James Dio and of course Cozy Powell, they were all at the very, very peak as musicians, with their inspirations and abilities. The weird thing is that it sounds like a band that's been together for 10 years, but I guess they just probably met a couple of weeks before they went into the studio or something, because Blackmore, he was always shuffling musicians around.
Absolutely. And I was watching an interview, I think it was maybe about 5 years ago, that you did with Face Culture, and you talked about seeing Rainbow live in Stockholm in 1976. So I'm guessing this will have been right either before or right when the album was released.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that show all those years later? What was that like?
I remember it very strongly. It was, I got the album like a month or two before the show. So, and I was like 12 years old at the time. So I didn't have any, I didn't know anything about rock concerts or, you know, venues or anything. But my best friend in school, his mother, she was a rock fan. And she saw this ad in the newspaper that Rainbow are going to come and play in Stockholm at the concert house. And she knew that both me and my friend, that we were really big fans of the band. So she went ahead and she bought tickets, and she went with me and my friend into Stockholm. You know, this was way before I was ever able to go to Stockholm, the big city, by myself. But she went with us. So it was me and my best friend and my best friend's mother sitting there, and we were up on the balcony. So I was sitting looking down over the rainbow. You know? And I was, so when I was leaning over the edge, I could see straight down on Cozy Powell's drum kit, and I saw Richie Blackmore, and you know, my first reaction was like, wow, these guys are actually living humans, you know, because I had only seen the pictures on the record sleeve before that. I didn't even, you know, you didn't have a clue what it was. It was something magic, and all of a sudden, there they were, living persons on stage, moving around and playing and making a hell of a lot of noise. I remember the show. The volume was, it was horrible. It was like an airplane just taking off or something, like really fucking loud. But I was like totally spellbound at that point. And then when Cozy Powell, when he did his drum solo with a drum riser that was elevating, he had like a hydraulic kind of drum riser, and smoke came out, and then he did his whatever drum solo rolls and stuff, and at the very end of the drum solo, a huge magnesium bomb went off. So it was like, wow, it was like Second World War, you know, live on stage. I think that was that night, I just felt like, this is what I'm going to do. I want to be a drummer. I want to be on stage, and I want to play drums and have, you know, like a big drum set and play for people. You know, I didn't know how to do it and how to get there, but I just felt like this is what I need to do. So I would say that was my revelation, you know, five gods on stage just, you know, telling me that, here, son, this is what you're going to do. And from that moment, I was just totally focused on, this is what I'm going to do. I want to be a musician, a drummer. All my friends at school, they wanted to play, you know, like football or ice hockey and stuff like that. I was like, no, I want to play drums.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, for anyone who is listening who, and to be fair, I think with this podcast, I think most people listening will be more than familiar with Rainbow. But as a band, they were born in 1975 after Deep Purple guitarist Richie Blackmore collaborated with Ronnie James Dio on a track called Black Sheep of the Family, which would end up appearing on Rainbow's first album, Richie Blackmore's Rainbow. Obviously, we've started to touch on these two guys already, and I'm sure we'll continue to. How important would you say is that dynamic between Blackmore and Dio on that early Rainbow sound we hear on those first three albums?
I think the matching between them is perfect. I mean, Blackmore, he had more, you know, when he was in Deep Purple, he had a much more, well, I mean, the whole approach of Deep Purple was more bluesier, you know, like blues driven and bluesier lyrics and stuff like that. But with Ronnie James Dio, I mean, you could tell that Richard Blackmore had more of a like Eastern influences, and I know that he liked the medieval kind of stuff. And with Ronnie James Dio, he got a vocalist that had the same approach, the same kind of lyrics and the same kind of drama out of this, you know, more like a mystical approach to the whole thing. So Ronnie James Dio and Richie Blackmore together made a perfect team, I think. A match in heaven.
So obviously Richie makes this decision to leave Deep Purple just with how much he's enjoying this collaboration with Ronnie, and he recruits members of Dio's band Elf to complete the first Rainbow album. So I know you'd said there that obviously you'd heard that one first. It's, well, you'd enjoyed it. It hadn't grabbed you in the same way that Rainbow Rising would. What do you make of that first album? Like, what do you know? Do you think that that musical and lyrical kind of union of the two of them, does that come across as early as that first album, or does it take a bit of time to settle in?
I would say it doesn't have that mystique, and it doesn't have that approach from the rest of the band. It doesn't feel like a totally unified. I mean, all the guys from Elf were great musicians, but still, it wasn't 100%. But you could definitely tell that it was going on the right way. I think there's something about the sound and the way the guys in the band played on the first album that didn't really grab me. It was a little bit too much honky-tonk rock, in my opinion. It was a totally different thing with the Rainbow Rising.
So Blackmore makes the decision he's going to fire with the exception of Dio, he fires the entire band following that first album, creating an all-new lineup that we've started to touch on for Rising. So he recruits Jimmy Bain on bass, Tony Kerry on keyboards, and he rounds off that lineup, as we've talked about, Cozy Powell on drums. Now, as a drummer yourself, you know, you witnessed that lineup live, you've talked already about that drum solo and the impact that had on you. How much of an influence has Cozy been on you as a drummer and a musician, particularly through his work on this album?
Well, I confess that I nicked a lot of drum fills from Cozy Powell from that album. I mean, if you listen to Rock the Night, I do a couple of fills that is actually totally copying from some of the of Cozy Powell's fills. His drum style, it just fit me. It just talked to me 100%. So, you know, still today, when I sit down and I play drums, I'm trying to figure out, okay, what should I play that suits the song? Then I find myself thinking, I wonder how Cozy Powell would have played this song, you know? So it's like he's in there somewhere in my mind all the time, and I kind of relate to him in my own playing all the time. I definitely would say that he has been the my mentor, even though I don't play everything trying to play exactly like Cozy Powell, but everything when it comes to inspiration and giving me the push into, you know, realizing that I wanted to become a drummer, I totally credit Cozy Powell for that, definitely.
So Jimmy Bain told a great story to Classic Rock magazine about the band auditioning drummers and why it was that they went with Cozy and why he stood out. So I'm just going to read you a bit of it. So he said the guy would come in, so obviously any other musicians they were auditioning, the guy would come in, set up his kit, and we'd go to the other side of the building and play pool. When he got comfortable, Richie would start this really fast riff. Dat, 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 dat. I'd join in on bass, the drummer would start playing along. That would be great for 5 minutes. After 20, the guy would be falling apart. Richie and me would stop playing and go back to the pool table without saying a word. We did this about 14 times. Nobody came close, and then Cozy arrived. Richie goes into his da-da-da-da-da routine. We do this for about 45 minutes, and the tempo doesn't fluctuate. We finished that, and before we could say anything, Cozy starts another beat on the double bass drum. We were trying to fuck him up, and he turns it around on us. He was in. And I think that obviously that shows him how amazing not only Cozy was, but the band. You know, we're going to be talking about how amazing everybody is in this process, but even that really rigorous audition process and Cozy even kind of, he even showed those guys up, you know what I mean, after 45 minutes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think Cozy, he had a strong self. I mean, he was a very experienced drummer when he came into the band. So, I mean, he probably had it all down, you know, with after Jeff Beck Group and Bedlam and everything that he had been doing before that. So I think he was probably very, you know, self-assured and he had his own, you know, well, actually he had his own name in England with the Dance with the Devil and his solo singles and everything. So maybe he was a bit like, well, whatever, if they don't like me, fuck them. maybe he was a bit more relaxed in his approach when he did the audition. I don't know really, but I totally agree. You know, when you listen to songs like A Light in the Black, for instance, it's like, you know, setting fire to a torch burner, and it burns with a steady fire until the gas runs out and then it dies off. He's like a steamroller. He just goes on with that same dynamic and the same rhythm and the same feel all over, all through the song. And I think that's, I mean, that song must be like between 8 and 9 minutes long, I think, and it's just he was like a machine.
So with this lineup complete, so Rainbow, they converge on Musicland Studios in Munich to record this album that would become Rising. And Tony Carey, he recalled that they couldn't quite get the drums to sound live enough, as he put it, because it was an archetypal 70s studio with rugs on the wall. So we got a wrecking crew together, hacked up the stairwell, and turned it into a concrete tomb. That's how Cozy got his sound. What do you make of the drum sound on this album? You know, do you think that, obviously, they were looking for a live sound? Do you think that's what they got on the finished product?
Oh, absolutely. I think, still today, the drum sound on Rainbow Rising is one of my favorite drum sounds of all times. It's so much alive. And it's, if you listen to it, it doesn't have that much bottom end to it, but it has that that mid bottom that hits you in the solar plexus, you know, in the middle of, you know, like if you play it really loud, it's like being kicked in the guts, and so it's a very, it sounds like standing in a room with a very like stone room behind or next to the drummer, you know, it sounds so much alive. It's just perfect. I love that sound and the way everything bleeds into each other. You know, all the sounds are mixing together in the room. You can tell that it is a live drummer playing in a loud room, and I think it's perfect. You know, it couldn't be any better. I know I read somewhere that Richie Blackmore himself said that he wasn't really too crazy about the mix because he thought it lacked bottom end. I don't agree to that. It sounds more like a it unifies the whole mix, I think, with the drums and the guitars and bass and everything. I think it's perfect.
So Richie brought in legendary producer Martin Birch to produce the album. So by this time, Birch had already worked with Deep Purple, Fleetwood Mac, among others. Of course, he'd later go on to work with Iron Maiden, Whitesnake, Black Sabbath. Can you hear much of Martin's influence on this album as a producer? Are there certain hallmarks that you hear on a Martin Birch album that maybe aren't elsewhere? Or is he the kind of producer that takes a step back and lets the band kind of present themselves?
You know, the brilliant thing I always thought about Martin Birch is that he always makes the band the best the band can sound. You know, he doesn't have a trademark, at least in my ears. He doesn't have a typical Martin Birch sound trademark. Trademark is that if the band sounds fucking awesome and everything is put together, then then that's that might be the his sign. But I think he did a great job on that album, as he did with all the Deep Purple albums and everything. But it's very hard to sound-wise tell that it's a Martin Birch production, I think. I'm really sorry I never got a chance to meet him or to work with him. But and another thing, well, actually, one signature thing with the Martin Birch productions is that he always had a great drum sound with Iron Maiden or Whitesnake or whatever band he was working with. He made the drummer, whoever it was, sound as good as he could to his abilities, you know. So I think that was the magic thing with Martin Birch's productions.
So I think, and we touched on this near the start of our chat, but I think what brings this album together so nicely is this combination of, you know, as you said, Richie embracing these kind of almost medieval, sometimes Eastern kind of sounds, that's now been coined the sort of neoclassical metal, as it's what it tends to be called, combined with that kind of the fantasy songwriting style from Ronnie. And I don't think we can overstate how hugely influential that's been over the decades. So Snowy Shaw, who was in bands like Merciful Fate and King Diamond, he said recently that Rising introduced a more Dungeons and Dragons type fantasy heavy rock to the masses.
Yeah.
Do you think that's it? I mean, to be fair, I know we could argue like Led Zeppelin had some kind of fantasy lyrics in there and stuff as well, but do you think that maybe that this union of Blackmore and Dio, do you think this is where it peaks? Do you think this is where that the genesis of that kind of strong relationship between fantasy and metal begins?
I think so. I mean, I read somewhere that I think it was Richie who said that, or someone said that Stargazer was very much influenced by Kashmir, by Led Zeppelin. And yeah, of course you can hear the similarities, but Led Zeppelin they had that song that sounded like that. And then they had songs that were totally different, you know, from very soft blues or whatever. But I think Rainbow Rising with Stargazer and Tarot Woman and, you know, A Light in the Black, whatever, they have some kind of a core throughout the whole album that it has that mystical kind of side to both the lyrics and the playing. And of course the Stargazer is the pinnacle of that. That's the you know, like the eruption of the album, so to say. It's that's where it's all peaking. But I think Rainbow Rising is a much more homogenic album than Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti album or whatever. I think the most homogenic album by Led Zeppelin, by the way, is Presence in that case, because it sounds like a unified album. But other than that, I think definitely Rainbow Rising is the highlight of all that, the inspiration and the mystical Eastern kind of sounds that happened between Richard Blackmore and Ronnie James Dio. Yeah.
So, I mean, recording Rising, it didn't take very long at all. So I've read things from just under a month to a few days. So depending on who you talk to.
Yeah.
In the Richie Blackmore biography, Black Knight, Cozy said at the sessions, I think the idea was to try and capture it as quickly as we could. It wasn't a manufactured record. It was done spontaneously. And the musician's input is the way you hear it, which is why it's possibly one of the better albums we did. And I feel there's some truth to that. I mean, I feel you can absolutely hear this, as you put it, this kind of raw energy and just explosion and chemistry from everyone on the album. There doesn't feel to be a weak link at all on this album. Everybody's kind of firing all cylinders at their peak, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. It's you can tell that all five are, you know, they're all on their toes and they're, you know, ready to give 100% and they do it. It's all about the vibe. I mean, if you listen really carefully, maybe you can hear that, you know, like, okay, maybe he should have done this and that there, but it, you know, it doesn't matter. It's the whole of it that makes the magic of it. It's the vibe and the whole spontaneity of the whole thing, I think, that you can hear. And you know, I actually, because I'm working as a radio DJ myself in Stockholm, you know, at a radio station. A couple of years ago, I had Tony Carey at the radio station. I did an interview with him and I asked him,
oh, cool.
Yeah, and I asked him about the Rainbow Rising album because, you know, I think it's so fantastic. And he was like, oh man, I can't hardly remember anything from it, because he had been, you know, like after the recording sessions and the tour, he just cut it off. He didn't want to know anymore. So when I played him the intro solo on Tarot Woman, he said, man, this is the first time I listened to this recording since we recorded it. So he hadn't heard it. Wow. And he was like, all right. Oh, that's cool. So he was like, I played pretty good. And he said that was, it was like a first take. It was, he was just jamming. The whole thing was just came out on one or two takes. And I think that says a lot when you consider how well it's played.
And I mean, as you kind of explained so well earlier on, you know, they were a hugely formidable live band, particularly kind of during this rising period. But famously, just as Richie had changed the lineup between the first and second Rainbow album, it wasn't long before Jimmy Bain was let go from the band. And across the next couple of albums, Tony Carey and Dio would follow. I'd read something actually. Well, we're talking about Carey a little bit. So I live in Durham, which is the northeast of England. It was apparently a show in Newcastle, which is literally about 20 minutes from my house at Newcastle City Hall, which is an amazing venue. If anyone, I don't know if Europe have ever played Newcastle City Hall before. It was actually at that venue where allegedly that Richie had gone up to Tony kind of during the set and told him just to leave.
Yeah.
And he walked off and that was the end of his time with Rainbow. Yeah. So interesting connection there.
Yeah.
I've got a quote from Richie. He was talking to Sounds Magazine in 1979, just talking about this kind of turnover in the band. And he'd said, if they were good enough, they'd still be in the band. I'm not putting down the other members who were in the band, but no one has ever left Rainbow. It's a fact. Not a confrontation, just, well, you didn't quite make it. You'll have to do other things. When people leave the band, we don't give too much reasons because we don't want to hinder their career. But if someone's not pulling their weight, then I will not put up with someone who's second rate. And I think that's really, I mean, it's very Richie, isn't it? But I think for me, you could argue, obviously, people will have their opinions about that kind of attitude and leadership of a band. But surely that's not only the reason the lineup changed so much, but surely a factor in why this album we're talking about was so fantastic, because his standards, he wasn't willing to go for anything less than what he deemed was 100%.
Yeah, that's right. I heard something that when he was putting together the lineup for Rainbow Rising, he was actually auditioning a keyboard player, Eddie Jobson, who used to play with Roxy Music. And who's also a virtuoso on the violin. He's an awesome keyboard player and violin player. And he didn't get the job because he was too good. Because he would put Richie Blackmore in the shadows, and Richie didn't like that. So he didn't, you know, let him in. I'm not sure if it's true, but, it wouldn't surprise me if Richie's mentality.
So, I mean, we're just about to go track by track, but before we do, you know, this album, obviously, it's left a huge legacy. Only 5 years after it was released in 1981, Kerrang! Magazine named it the greatest heavy metal album of all time, and it still holds that kind of esteem, even with the throngs of amazing metal albums that have followed it. I mean, it's 45 years old this year. What kind of influence would you say this album is still having on rock and metal, kind of 45 years on?
I think it's still, I mean, for me personally, I can only say, if there comes a day when I feel, you know, like lost, or if I, you know, lost my way in one way or another, you know, if I put on that album, grab hold of the record sleeve and look at the pictures, and it's like, it takes me back right on track again. It has become like it's more than a cornerstone in my wall that I call my life. You know, it defines me and my purpose as a musician, I would say. But I mean, for me, it's a little bit extreme in that sense. But I think musically, it has definitely, like, take for instance, Yngwie Malmsteen. He actually, I would say, built his whole career, at least at an early stage, sounding, you know, very much like the Rainbow Rising, the taking that whole concept and into his own career, sort of. I know that Stargazer, for instance, has been covered by a lot of bands, and the album seemed to have a lot of influences on the newer bands, I guess.
So let's go track by track. As you'd said, there's only six tracks, but obviously really kind of weighty album in that sense, in terms of, I don't feel like you say it doesn't need any more than that. I think it's perfect as it is. So let's go with that opening track, Tarot Woman. So we've talked a lot already about Blackmore, Dio and Cozy, you know, but the first thing we hear on this album is that you were lucky enough to be able to play for Tony, that stunning kind of intro that he did on keyboards. And obviously you'd said his reaction kind of listening back for the first time in however many years was positive.
Yeah.
What do you think of that intro of Tower of Woman, especially for it being like the beginning of the album?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a typical heavy metal intro, really, because it's really quite long, and it's it's quite subtle. It's not like aggressive, or it doesn't set any, you know, any particular tone for what is to come. But it's just beautifully played. And I mean, for me, for some reason, I always loved the sound of synthesizers. So to me, when I heard that Mini Moog intro, I was spellbound immediately. I was like, wow, amazing. And with the delays and the harmonies and stuff building up, and then going into that, you know, when Richard Blackmore's guitar is being faded up, I was mesmerized. I was kind of drawn into another world, really. Yeah.
So in that Black Knight biography I've quoted a couple of times, Tony says that everybody left and I sat with Martin for an hour and a half. Blackmore never said a word, never told me which instrument to play. He said, just play what you feel. And I think that's what I like about this, that, you know, obviously we get this vibe sometimes that he was almost dictatorial with the way the band was, but there was obviously a lot of trust from him on this album towards his bandmates to bring these songs to life.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. All the musicians, everyone seemed to be delivering at 100%. And I mean, the way Cozy Powell enters into the song with that drum fill, it just knocked me off the seat, because I never heard anything like that sound-wise or play-wise. I nicked that drum fill at the very end of Rock the Night. I took that from the intro fill to Terror of Woman that Cozy Powell plays on the album. So and from then on, when the song starts and it just stomps into Ronnie James Dio's vocals and all that, it's like jumping on a freight train and just trying to hold on, you know, because it's so powerful and it just shoots you through the night. And you know, it's an amazing power in that song.
And I think, you know, obviously we've talked about Tony's solo at the start, in that, you know, I think you'd said earlier on, from what Richie said in a quote of Classic Rock magazine, that was his first solo that he did for the song. So, you know, this is something that was very much off the cuff and he did it. You know, again, a lot of, we were talking about that spontaneity in the band, just getting in there and doing it. Is there something to that? So when you're in the studio, is it sometimes that first burst of inspiration that you could be there for another couple of hours or whatever, but you're never going to beat what you did the first time?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me personally, when we record with Europe, it's usually within not more than four takes. Usually between the first and the second take will be the one that you keep for the record. That's where you're on your edge, on the edge, and you're on your toes, and you deliver that, you know, excitement and tension. And sometimes you don't even know for yourself really where it's going to go, but you just try to hold on. So it's definitely the first couple of takes that are the best. And I think you can show that, or you can tell, it shows on the Rainbow Rising album that they probably did the same way.
So Classic Rock Review saved Terror Woman. This opening track has a definitive Deep Purple quality, especially during Blackmore's soaring guitar lead. Is that something you'd agree with, or do you think that because obviously of Richie's presence, they're always inevitably going to be compared to Deep Purple simply because of that link?
Actually, I think Terror Woman is not a typical Richie Blackmore riff-driven song, like Man on the Silver Mountain, for instance. That's a typical Richie Blackmore riff, I would say. Terror Woman is a bit more, I don't know, it's a bit more stompy and, you know, driving, just single string driving in a way. But definitely, I mean, the way Richie Blackmore plays his guitar solos. Actually, I think also that Rainbow Rising is probably the turning point in a way for Richie Blackmore, because after Rainbow Rising, it, at least in my opinion, he started playing a little bit more sloppy in a way. I don't know. He felt a little bit too sure about himself, I guess, and just let go of it. But I think Rainbow Rising is the pinnacle of his ability. And he's got a very typical kind of guitar soloing, and that shows on the Terror Woman, definitely.
A really influential album, not just on Ian, but just on so many musicians that have followed. And we're going to continue my chat with Ian Haugland about Rainbow Rising in just a little bit. And don't forget, of course, the chat about Stargaze is coming up too, which is arguably the centerpiece of that album. So that's absolutely fantastic. But first, some more music. And when I was chatting to Ian about this, following our conversation with Rising, he agreed that he felt that this song best showcased the influence and the love that his band have for Rainbow and the Rising album. So it seemed like the perfect song to play today here on My Classic Albums. So here are Swedish rock legends Europe with a track from their 2017 album of the same name. This is Walk the Earth. Move on to Run With The Wolf, so the album's officially off to the races. Tower Woman gives way to this kind of bluesy groove of Run With The Wolf, and Sputnik Music save it with memorable guitar licks and bass lines combined with rhythmic organ, steady drumming, and a signature Dio chorus. The quality of the album can't be denied. For those who might not be familiar, and I know we had, funnily enough, we did do an episode about Holy Diver a couple of years ago, so our listeners are probably quite familiar with Dio at this point, but for those who maybe aren't, is this a good example of that kind of fantasy-inspired songwriting that we've been talking about? I know that reaches a peak, certainly, with Stargazer later on.
Yeah, yeah. I think, as you said, the chorus especially has that more kind of mystique kind of vibe to it. While the song in itself, I mean, the main verse riff is more signature Richard Black, more bluesy, I think. But I like that. I like that the change that it shows between the verse and into the chorus. It becomes so evident, you know, when you go from the verse into the chorus, it kind of takes off and it lifts. And it's a beautiful composition in that way, I think.
So there's an online blog called Al Musing, and they single out the song as a highlight of the album, saying Run With The Wolf is edgy, with lots of attitude from all the musicians. Dio is amazing as always, delivering his powerful voice with emotion and intensity. His parts are laid back but still driving, and his creativity is evident in how he makes slight changes to his phrasing and even uses different melodies for each chorus. And we've talked so much about his songwriting and his voice, and I was lucky enough to see Dio with Heaven and Hell before his passing in 2009, I think I saw him. You know, do you think that these more subtle elements of his singing are forgotten? These kind of slight changes to phrasing and inflection with that power and image that he has. Do you think sometimes the more subtle elements of his subtle strengths get maybe overlooked sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, he's Ronnie James Dio is, in my opinion, he's the there will never be another hard rocker or metal singer that has his abilities and power and range and dynamic and, how should I say, the it's, you know, when he sings something, if he sings about Dungeons and Dragons, you fucking believe in Dungeons and Dragons, you know. It's he's so real in his expression. He has such a dynamic voice at that point of his career in 1976. His range was just scary, you know. And he uses all his weapons, you know. He's when he sings soft, he's just like, he's frail as a summer breeze, and then he can roar like a lion in the next couple of seconds, you know. So and he does all of that just beautifully. I think that Run With The Wolf is, there's some nice harmonies and stuff in the bridge part and all that, and also, you know, yeah, it's just showcase of his dynamics and powers, I think.
I can't remember. I wish I could remember when it was that I'd read it, but just to stay on Dio for a second, just while I'm thinking about it, I remember reading something. It was about, obviously, his time in Black Sabbath, and it was no dig at Ozzy, but it was someone basically saying that when Ozzy sings Black Sabbath songs, it's almost like there's like a fear in his voice, like he's fearful of the devil or he's fearful of whatever they're singing about. Whereas with Dio, like you say, it's this almost kind of this balls to the wall, like, confidence in, like, no, I'm gonna face up to this. And so in that sense, although both fantastic singers in both fantastic eras of Black Sabbath, very different singers. And again, I think, you know, Rainbow Rising is a really good example of Dio as a vocalist and kind of why people really connected with him so much.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I think the album after Rainbow Rising, Long Live Rock and Roll, Ronnie James Dio's singing technique is even more dynamic when it goes from you know, like Gates and Babylon and Long Live Rock and Roll down to Rainbow Eyes, the end track, where he's so soft in his voice, you know. So in that sense, when it comes to Ronnie James Dio's abilities, I think actually Long Live Rock and Roll is a better album.
Interesting. So Ultimate Classic Rock had said about Run With The Wolf, they single it out as a potential single, but they also call it easily Rising's weakest link. So I guess there's two questions in there. Do you think it would have made a strong single? And if there is one, do you think it's the weak link on the album?
No, in my personal opinion, it's not a weak link. But I don't really, actually, I don't, if I would work at a, you know, like a record company, I would have a hard time picking a single from Rainbow Rising, honestly. It's, you know, if you go to the first album, well, Black Sheep of the Family or Man on the Silver Mountain, for sure, and Long Live Rock and Roll is a typical single in my ears. But on Rainbow Rising, I wouldn't pick it as a single, but it's definitely not a weak spot. It fills a certain space within the framework of what is Rainbow Rising. If you took it away, it would be halting in a way, I think.
Interesting link into that. I know, obviously, you know, I think a lot of the reason that Rainbow changed so much, and obviously Richie was chasing that more kind of commercial sound that would provide hit singles on the charts kind of after Dio's time with the band. Do you think that's why? Do you think, obviously, this isn't necessarily, while it's an amazing album, it's not necessarily full of obvious singles immediately, and do you think that's maybe why Richie eventually decided to go down that route of albums that have tracks like Since You Were Gone and things that are maybe more radio-friendly, I guess?
Yeah, probably. I mean, from what I understood, Richie Blackmore was a bit fed up with just having bearded men in the audience and not having any songs played on the radio. So I guess that's why he started leaning towards more commercial sounds on Long Live Rock and Roll. And then actually the song L.A. Connection on Long Live Rock and Roll reminds me a bit of Run with the Wolf, but it has a bit more of a commercial sound to it. I think Richie Blackmore was probably ready to try the commercial strength of his songwriting, and I don't know. I actually, when they went full force and sang Ronnie James Dio and released Down to Earth, I was so mad, you know, when I heard Since You've Been Gone. I got so mad that I took it like a 4-inch nail and I scratched it off the vinyl. Scratched it off the vinyl so I couldn't play it. I didn't want it to exist. That couldn't be my rainbow. So, yeah, that was my reaction on the whole, the commercial steps that Richard took.
Interestingly, we were talking about singles and stuff. It was actually Starstruck, our next track, that was chosen as a single. It didn't chart from any research that I've done, but it was chosen as the single, and it has proven to be a popular Rainbow track ever since. What are your thoughts on Starstruck, kind of at this point in the album? Kind of, what do you think of the track?
I thought it was pretty good. It's they played it live. I remember at least parts of it, maybe not the whole song, and that's another weird thing that they never played any. Well, they played Stargazer at some points, but they never played the whole... I mean, in my opinion, they could have played the whole Rainbow Rising album live, but they, you know, that was kind of weird, but probably Richard Blackmore's opinion on how to deal with things. But Starstruck, yeah, it's a up-tempo shuffle kind of groove with a interesting lyric about a Starstruck groupie or fan or stalker or whatever. But in my opinion, I think actually that is probably the weakest track in my opinion on the album. I mean, it's not bad, but it's not the strongest song in my opinion. I like the Richard Blackmore's slide guitar solo and kind of the shuffly groove of the song. It's kind of nice, yeah.
And obviously talking about that the lyrics in that song, so yes, you're absolutely right. It is about kind of like a starstruck fan or a stalker or whatever you want to call her, actually based on a genuine fan who was following Blackmore cross-country at times. So a French lady named Muriel. Blackmore recalled, he said, "We play a concert in Paris, she'd be there. Then we'd fly to Lyon and she'd be at the airport waiting. One day, I looked out my window and I thought I saw the bushes move in the garden. I kept watching and sure enough, she'd found my house. So I set my dogs on her."
Yeah, well it brings a new meaning to the song when you tell that story.
But I think as well it just shows, because I mean, to be fair, like as we say, you know, Ronnie, Cozy, Richie, you know, all these guys, they had come from other bands, and obviously he was already a hugely revered guitarist before he'd even kind of put this band together. So I guess that just shows how revered he was at the time, that he would have someone who would follow him to the ends of the earth like that.
Yeah. We had, well, maybe not that bad, but we had some fans, you know, showing up in you play in Japan and whoever is there, and then you go to South America 2 weeks later and the same person is in South America. And I mean, you should be happy for that, because it's, these guys love you that much that they spend all the fucking money in order to travel around the world just to come and see your show. But at the same time, it's a little scary, you know.
Yeah.
It makes you think like, well, these people, don't they have anything else to, you know, like maybe, you know, kids or family that they need to support with that money. But, you know, at the same time, it's a mixed feeling there.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we talked about that kind of Deep Purple rainbow comparison that's often inevitably going to happen. Sputnik Music called Starstruck easily the most Deep Purplish of the tracks on here, with organ and vocals that could have come compliments of John Lord and Ian Gillan, respectively. Do you see that connection? Is that something you'd agree with?
Yeah. It's probably the most Deep Purplish kind of riff, I think, on the album. Yeah, or one of them. So it could have been a purple song, I guess.
So as we get to the end of side one, we get to Do You Close Your Eyes, which is the shortest track on the album. Classic Rock Review call it the most ordinary song on the album, a pretty standard hard rock song in the vein of mid-70s contemporaries like Kiss. Now, for me, that seemed a strange comparison. Obviously, we've done a couple of Kiss albums on the podcast, and it's no knock on Kiss. I'm a Kiss fan. I didn't immediately make that connection between this song and it sounding like a Kiss song. Was that something, you know, can you kind of get where they're coming from there?
Yeah, it's, well, maybe not Kiss, but it's definitely more of a standard rock riff that he pulls off there, Richard Blackmore. But again, it has that aggression again, and Cozy Powell delivers the powers from his drums, and also Ronnie James Dio's song singing is much more up there, high pitched vocals and catchy chorus, I think. And I know they play that song live at the end of the at the end of the set in 1976. Like an upspeeded version of the song. In the beginning, I thought, the first time I heard it, I thought it was A Light in the Black they played, but it was actually a upsped version of Do You Close Your Eyes, from what I understood. But it's a more regular track, but still, I think it's probably, in my opinion, more appealing than Starstruck.
And I mean, obviously, again, just to point out again, they call it the most ordinary song on the album. And I wonder if that's maybe a bit unfair in some ways, because we know we're about to go over to side two, to these two really epic songs that we're about to talk about. We've got that hindsight that we've listened to this album. We know what's to come. Do you think comparing like a 2 or 3 minute song, which is maybe a bit more in the vein of what was going on in the mid 70s, to a song like Stargazer is a bit unfair?
Well, yeah. I mean, the album takes a new life. It gets a new life once you turn it to side two. It becomes a different album, I think. It completes the album in a way. I think if Rainbow Rising would have only been side two kind of style music, then it might have been a little bit too over the top. But I think the songs like Do You Close Your Eyes and Starstruck and Run With The Wolf, they balance the album out a little bit. Because I remember myself when I had the Rainbow Rising on vinyl, I usually listen to side one for maybe a week, and then I, you know, flip the record, and then I listen to side two for a week, and then I flip back. So it was actually like two albums for me.
Yeah, let's go on to side two. In some ways, that second album, if you like, because it is. And anyone, and I say this occasionally with certain songs on the podcast. If you're listening to this and you haven't heard this song before, absolutely stop what you're doing, go and listen to it, and come back. So it's the absolute centerpiece of this album. We've talked about it or alluded to it a few times. Huge showcase for everyone involved, and obviously we'll go through it quite a bit. But it opens that side, this blistering show of force from Cozy Powell on drums. You know, obviously we've talked about his influence on you. We've talked about kind of all of that sort of stuff. What do you make of his performance at the beginning here? Well, in fact, the whole track.
Well, I get goosebumps just thinking about that. That intro drum roll that it does, it pulls off, it's like 4 bars or something, or 8 bars maybe. It's long and stretched out, and it's really, really tight and really, really technical. You know, when the first time I heard it, I never heard anything like it. I was just, I couldn't believe my ears, you know, when I heard it the first time. It was like, this is something else, you know. It had everything. It had the power, it had the... It had the sound, and it had the drive, and it set up the song for you know, the way it takes into the song is just magical. I remember I tried to copy that feel and try to learn it, and it took a long time to figure it out, because it's I mean, it's not super complicated, but it's to get that flow and to, you know, the way Cozy Powell plays it's just amazing. And the funny thing, I have to say, when they played that song live, he didn't do that fill. When they played the song live, Tony were playing a keyboard solo, and then it went from there. It just like in the beginning of Terror Woman, it just faded into Stargazer. So he just did a short fill, like not at all like on the album. So I remember I was disappointed when they played that song live, but. Yeah, the intro fill on the album is one of the most amazing drum intros ever.
So Richie, he kind of almost, I guess, composed, devised the riff for Stargazer on the cello, which is perhaps kind of the one of the best examples we can give of him embracing classical music and evolving his sound at this point. What do you think that classical element, and obviously we know there's kind of an orchestra comes in towards the end, but what does that classical element bring to Stargazer that might have been missing otherwise without that?
I'm amazed that no... you know, like a symphonic orchestra has ever made a version of that song, because it could have been an orchestral piece from the beginning to the end, you know, just with an orchestra playing it, because it's so orchestral. From what I understand, they recorded the song with the Munich Philharmonic Orchestra, but they chose to not use much of it in the mix because it sounded too much like in a symphony orchestra and not a rock band. You know, that song to me is a classical work. It could have been might as well played only with an orchestra.
And it's interesting you should talk about that. I've got a quote from Blackmore from Classic Rock magazine, and he said the reason that he wasn't happy with it, he said the orchestra was too flowery. There was too much detracting from the simple melody. We kept taking out parts, and I felt sorry for Rayner, who was the composer, because he was so proud of this grandiose piece that he'd written. We got down to the bare bones and mixed in some Mellotron to even out the orchestra not sounding cohesive or in tune. I mean, what do you think of that? Obviously, they've taken a lot out, as we've talked about. What do you think of that kind of that orchestra at the climax of Stargazer? Because I think it does, you know, that finished product is really nice. I think it does add something really special. Do you think they could have built on that more? Do you think they got it right? What do you think?
Well, maybe a little bit more of the orchestra in the at the end, you know, to really make a huge climatic kind of vibe to it. But at the same time, I understand his thinking there, not to give it away too much and to you, because if you use too much, you know, strings in a rock song, you tend to smear it out and take away the edges, you know, like if you use an orchestra without finesse, really, if you just blast it up there, so you have to be really, really careful when you're blending in the orchestra into the rock music, I think. So he's probably very right in his decision there. But in my opinion, I think he could have used it a bit more and made it stand out even further, you know, towards the end of the song.
So lyrically, the song's about a wizard who enslaves others to build a tower for him to fly from, only for when he does so that he falls to his death. Obviously, I've heard it called a morality tale. Essentially, in my opinion, and I would say this, not just for the album, but perhaps his career, it's one of the strongest examples of Dio's kind of mystical fantasy storytelling. If we're saying that this album is kind of influential in that regard, which we did, how important would you say is Stargazer in that development of that relationship between fantasy and metal? Is this kind of ground zero, as it were?
Yeah, I think it's one of the, lyric-wise, it's one of the cornerstones of that whole majestic, mystical kind of rock. I think it has influenced thousands of bands and thousands of songs, the lyrics of Stargazer, and the way Ronnie tells the story, it's almost like a, you know, it's like a film script, you know, it's yeah. Almost like the Lord of the Rings or whatever, you know, like the end battle or whatever. It's so graphic, the whole lyric and the music to match it. Because I remember when I listened to Stargazer, especially in my younger years, it was like I saw a, you know, like a movie being played in my head, really.
Yeah.
So I think Stargazer is probably one of the most influential songs when it comes to that genre. Yeah.
And I guess it's all the elements of the song are important with that too. So, you know, there's the sounds and the influences that Richie was exploring, the use of the orchestra and the classical instruments, and then Ronnie's songwriting and performance. It's just, and this is why I was saying to people, if they've not heard it, to go back and listen to it, because it's just the perfect combination. We've been talking about this album being the right people at the right time in their career and all of this. I think this feels like the culmination of that, absolutely.
Yeah, in every sense, it's a perfect match, and it's a perfect composition. You know, you can't even come close to making a song, you know, that sounds, you know, as soon as you just get close to what Stargazer sounds like, it's going to be a dead copy of Stargazer. That's how special that song is, I think.
So So you've touched a little bit already about, obviously, that they did do it live, you know, because he didn't do the fill and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, but it, from what I've heard, is that sometimes Stargazer would be a bit of a showstopper. They could stretch it out for as long as 17 minutes. I mean, it's a long song anyway. In terms of your memory of that, was that a one that they really, like you say, that they stretched out? Was it kind of like a 15, 16 minute piece when you saw it live?
Probably. But you see, they tend to stretch almost every song. You know, like they played Man on the Silver Mountains for 10 minutes because they went from, in the middle of Man on the Silver Mountain, they went into the blues jam, and then they went back to the end part of Man on the Silver Mountain, and then they played Catch the Rainbow, and that would be for 17, 18 minutes with a stretched out guitar intro that was like, oh, it was so long. And I remember when I saw them live in 77 and 76 or 77, the only times I felt a little bit like bored, how I should put it, that was in those places where Richie had his guitar, you know, like jerk offs, and taking forever, you know. I remember the version of Stargazer was stretched out, but that to me was just like a stretched out, you know, orgasm. I was a little bit too young for orgasms at that time, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on to that final track. So we've got A Light in the Black, another 8-minute epic. Classic Rock Review state that it completes the album, sets a template for the future sound of groups like Judas Priest and Iron Maiden, which I think is an interesting statement. Do you feel that, does A Light in the Black, does it have an almost like a new album, like a new wave of British heavy metal vibe that the likes of Maiden might take inspiration from in a few years' time?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it has that raw power. It's really breathtaking. The playing is just amazing. And it almost has a little bit like a punk attitude to it, you know, it's really raw and really, but still very well played by them. And I guess it's that, again, that's probably a song that they did on the first or second take or something. So it keeps that raw, fresh power from the beginning to till the end. I don't think Judas Priest ever came up to that kind of energy level. I mean, they must have been 76. They released Sinner the year after, in 1977. And then, well, the first, in my opinion, the first heavy metal album by Judas Priest was probably Stained Class with Exciter, and Exciter has that a little bit, but I think yeah, A Light in the Black is probably one of the forerunners for the you know, like the British heavy metal kind of sound that arose in the early 80s.
So, I mean, some have said, including Dio, have said that it's A Light in the Black's a continuation of the story from Stargazer. So Dio said it continues the story of those who were enslaved by the wizard, who feel that they've lost all purpose once they felt it was death. Is that something you're aware of? Had you made that association? Do you feel, are they, especially with them being kind of all together on one side of vinyl or however you're listening, do you feel like they are two companion songs?
No, I never really understood that. But yeah, when you're mentioning it, I can understand the connection. No, to me it was when I grew up with the album, that song was more of a blast of power, you know. It was like a release in a way after the mystic vibe and all that with Stargazer. When A Light in the Black comes on, it becomes almost like a, you know, opening up the windows and letting some fresh air in, because it's Stargazer is so dense, you know. It's in my opinion, A Light in the Black is it's refreshing in that sense. And I never saw it as anything else but a very powerful, you know, rocker that you're blown away by.
So, I mean, obviously, we've waxed lyrical over Stargazer there. That is the track that gets the most love on this album. Sputnik Music did give some love for A Light in the Black, saying it's just as powerful as Stargazer. Blackmore's unforgettable intro riff, Bane's great bass line set the tone for Dio's vocals, and some truly amazing synth and guitar soloing. By the time the solo has run its course, it's certainly made more than a minor impression. Do you think, obviously, again, bearing in mind we were saying this about tracks earlier in the album, do you think that A Light in the Black's maybe a bit underrated due to the love that Stargazer gets when people talk about this album?
Yeah, definitely. I think A Light in the Black, you know, ends up in the shadow of the tower that was built up during Stargazer, definitely. And also, since it's such a long track, it's probably, you know, maybe people in general, maybe they didn't pay that much attention to A Light in the Black in the same sense as with Stargazer. So I can imagine that people tend to forget about it a little bit. But it's I mean, the solo blistering by both Tony Carey and Richard Blackmore in the middle of the song is really amazing. And it sounds like they must have played it live in the studio and trading solos between them as they recorded it. It sounds very much recorded live in my ears.
Yeah. I mean, how does it end the album for you? We've said, you know, it's an album that's, you know, it's only 30-something minutes, 6 tracks. It packs that punch. As we get to the end of the album, you know, how does A Light at the Black end the album for you?
It's just like, oh, man, can I light a cigarette now? It's one of those moments. No, but it's you're absolutely, you're run over by that. You know, it's like waking up after you've just been hit by a freight train. You know, everything is said, everything is done. You're totally drained of energy. But, you know, for me, it was like take 2 deep breaths and then turn it over and start all over again and start listening again. It took and it gave energy to me listening to that album. It's really powerful. The ending is very powerful and it's very definite, you know, the very end of Light in the Black. So that also makes the end so evident. It's like, all right, with the last fill and then it's just dead quiet. You really get the feeling that, wow, you lived through like an earthquake and I'm still alive. You know, it's an amazing power that you being have been struck by.
So while this classic Rainbow lineup, it was only around for a relatively short space of time. Rising, it's the sound of lightning in a bottle. You know, with Blackmore and Dio, as we've said, they've set in that blueprint for hordes of rock and metal bands that followed. And AllMusic sum up why this album is so highly regarded. So they say, on their second release, Rainbow not only avoid the sophomore jinx, they hit a home run. After replacing the entire band, except Dio, immediately following the recording of the first album, Richie Blackmore and the Rising lineup had plenty of time on the road touring the first album to get the chops and material together for their second. The material is uniformly strong. All 6 songs on the albums are up there with anything the band had done before or since. The playing has a very tight, colourful feel to it, which was lacking on the first record. This album can legitimately be mentioned in the same breath as classic Deep Purple. With that in mind, why has Rising stood the test of time for you?
Because it's 100% real. It's 100% live musicianship. It's 100% the focus on the songwriting, the production, the sound, the core of the whole production is... It just holds together and all the songs match each other to create this unit that is just it's as immortal as a pyramid. You know, it just sits there and will sit there forever, you know, because it's so perfect and it's so homogenic.
And finally, why is Rising your classic album and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Well, I it's hard to say because people probably think differently these days. But if you want to hear superior playing, superior songwriting, and a superior interaction between the greatest musicians of their time, just a perfect metal album from the record sleeve till the last finishing chord of A Light in the Black, you know, it's everything is just a match in heaven, you know. So it's perfect. Don't miss it.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us for our 50th episode and picking such an awesome album to talk about. I know, obviously, you know, I think the last year has really kind of knocked everybody about. What are the plans for Europe kind of going into this year and the next? Is there a new album coming out or a tour or anything like that planned?
Yeah, well, we are working on some new stuff, some new songs, but the pandemic has, you know, like as with every other band, made it impossible to you know really rehearse together in a rehearsal room and stuff. But we're, everybody's working on stuff, music, and we have some gigs booked. We don't know if they're going to happen if the COVID situation is going to be stable enough, but if it is, we're going to be doing maybe 5 or 6 shows throughout the summer, and then a couple of shows later in the autumn. So, but it's still, everything is a little bit up in the air. So we just kind of trying to take it day by day and just keep in touch and keep hopes high for the future. But I'm sure that everything will be going the right way from now on. So if not this summer, next summer, definitely we will be out there working hard again.
What a way to celebrate 50 episodes of My Classic Album. Thank you very much to Ian Haugland from Europe. And thank you for the choice as well, Rainbow Rising. You know, phenomenal album, phenomenal musicians, just everything about it. It just seemed like the perfect choice for episode 50. So again, as you'd heard there, Europe planning to get back into the studio, hoping to get some tours done. I know there was a festival date they've had to cancel over here in the UK, but hopefully we'll get them over next year. And I'm really looking forward to seeing them again. You know, I've always really enjoyed them as a live band. Fantastic. So keep watching out for future stuff with Europe, you know, as prolific now as they've ever been. So thank you very much once again for joining me. Just a couple of things to get out of the way now. Exciting times. We're going to reveal the winner of the 50 Album Showdown, and we're going to reveal that mystery guest that's coming up in a few weeks' time. So let's do the showdown first. Let's get that out of the way, because I know that's been something that's been rumbling on a little bit longer. So we'll have some tension music. I really like, and this is probably sounds like sacrilege, and you know, but I really like that tension music they have on like X Factor and that kind of thing. That's what I was hoping for. I thought that would be cool. But so we've had 50 albums, 50 classic albums, from Revolver by the Beatles at the very beginning, you know, right through to Rising by Rainbow, which we've done today. All 50 had the same opportunity, the same chance to win the 50 Album Showdown. And it came down to, obviously, to two albums. And I can reveal that the winner of the 50 Album Showdown is... Appetite for Destruction is our winner of the 50 Album Showdown. Joining me now, the guy who chose it as his classic album way back in episode 24, this is Skunk Manhattan. How are you feeling that your classic album has won out amongst a huge, huge selection of classic albums that we've done?
Yeah, man, I saw a lot of those selections and all that. There's just endless iconic stuff, so it's pretty cool that Appetite took the title, man. I mean, it's one of those things, like, you know, so many of those albums are just, they're all masterpieces, you know. But yeah, when we had talked about the reason for me choosing Appetite, I mean, for one, it's, you know, just a timeless great album, and I think, I could be wrong, I think at one point it was the highest selling debut album, is that correct?
It might still be, certainly in America. I think it might still be.
Yeah, well, I imagine nowadays they're not going to have sales, nobody sells, you know, sells like that anymore, so... you know, without streaming and stuff, so maybe it'll just hold that title forever. But yeah, man, and it, for me, it was, you know, when we talked on your podcast and everything, it was just, it was that was such a pivotal moment of my life, hearing that album, and having heard some classic rock and some different stuff, and then hearing that and just being like, at first, like, oh, what is this, that satanic heavy metal stuff? Oh my gosh, you know, like this, well, I think I was probably 12 or 13 or something, you know, and then I just started listening to it and just got hooked on it. It changed everything. I started buying rock records and getting into metal. And I mean, that album, like to kind of pinpoint that as the thing that made me want to play guitar. So I was like, well, it's got to be that album for me. Clearly, it's had that impact on many, many, many people.
And I mean, it's one of mine. Like, if you were in my top five, it's definitely in there. I mean, just some of the albums that beat out kind of individually in the rounds. Moving Pictures by Rush, Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones, Holy Diver by Dio, and Night at the Opera by Queen, and then of course Rumours by Fleetwood Mac in the final. So none of these are shabby albums by any stretch.
Oh yeah, Rumours? I mean, come on. Yeah, Rumours, that's one of those I grew up with as a kid, you know, and it's just flawless. I think the Black Album was in there for a good minute too, and
yeah,
that's another one that's just, you know, mint, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, it must feel good to know that obviously the album you chose is the one that kind of our listeners agree, at least out of the 50 we've done, is the most classic album. If you were to come back on sometime, what is there another album that you'd want to talk about that you think would be good?
Golly, it's a tough call, you know? There's just so many great iconic albums. I would want to probably do one that you haven't done. I don't know if anyone's done Master of Puppets, might be one, or something Pink Floyd, you know, just any of that 70s Pink Floyd stuff, man. I mean, obviously Dark Side, you know. Has someone done Dark Side of the Moon yet?
No, we've done Animals, but not Dark Side yet.
Oh, Animals, that's a cool one. Yeah, I love that album. Great album.
Yeah.
I could go with any of those. You know, another one would be, and I mean, there's just tons and tons of great Beatles stuff, and you could pick any of that, Revolver, Rubber Soul, whatever, Sgt. Pepper, all great. But I think Abbey Road is another one of my absolute all-time favorite albums.
Well, no, have a think. Like I say, I've got some really cool episodes coming up, but then obviously towards the back end of the year, that'll be when I'm starting to kind of get some other people on. So we'll have a chat at that point, and we'll see what we can do.
That'd be perfect, man. Thanks for getting in touch. Pretty cool.
Awesome. Absolutely. Well, you take care, and again, congratulations for picking kind of the ultimate classic album.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me.
Skunk Manhattan there, talking about his chosen classic album, the winner of the 50 album showdown, Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction. And as he was saying there, hopefully we'll get him back on, one of my favorite guests that we've had, you know, and some awesome choices that he's talking about there. So, you know, hopefully, you know, there'll be an episode about Dark Side of the Moon or Abbey Road or something like that in the near future. But we've got some amazing albums that we're going to be talking about over the next few months on My Classic Album, and we can talk about three of those episodes right now. So in a couple of weeks' time, as we've touched on already in the show, Jonathan Antoine, Britain's Got Talent finalist, classically trained tenor, has chosen Jeff Buckley's Grace as his classic album. You can hear our conversation about that in a couple of weeks' time. In August, on the 1st of August to be precise, Emily Johansson from Swedish band Thunder Mother is joining me to finally talk about an Iron Maiden album on My Classic Album. I can't believe it's taken us over 50 episodes. We're going to dive into Power Slave. Awesome stuff. But in between that, we have a very, very special guest coming onto the show on the 15th of July. I've kept my cards very close to my chest as to the identity of this Rock and Roll Hall of Famer who was chosen Aladdin Sane by David Bowie as his classic album, and now seems as good a time as any to reveal who that man is. So here is the very, very start of the interview. I'm literally just going to play you the first 10 seconds. That'll be all you need to know in terms of who it is. So sit back and enjoy. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Aladdin Sane. But I have here with me my very special guest who chose the album to talk about today. A huge thrill for me personally. From Def Leppard, this is Phil Collin. How's it going?
Wonderful, thank you. Good to be here.
No, your ears do not deceive you. That indeed was Phil Collin, legendary guitarist from Def Leppard. He will be appearing on My Classic Album in just 4 weeks' time to talk about David Bowie's Aladdin Sane album. That's a sentence it's just madness that I get to say that. Thank you so much to Phil for coming on the show and joining. And again, you'll hear that chat in full in 4 weeks' time. Just to get that flavour of Def Leppard as well, you know, if that's something that you're excited about and you're gearing up for, they've just released the third box set of their album retrospectives on CD and vinyl. That one, I believe, includes 2002's X, 2006's covers album Yeah, in which coincidentally they cover Driving Saturday, which appears on Aladdin Sane, and 2008's Songs from the Sparkle Lounge, which is actually one of my favourite Def Leppard albums. So that's out on CD and vinyl. There's loads of new stuff on there too. Phil will talk about that in the interview. That's out now, so that's available to buy. So absolutely, you know, if you're a Def Leppard fan, you want to get geared up, I've been listening to them in the car constantly since I heard he was coming on the show, get yourself that box set, you know, absolutely. But yeah, if you want to hear my chat with Phil, make sure that you're listening to episode 52 of My Classic Album, Aladdin Sane with Phil Collin. We've also got an amazing episode coming up in 2 weeks' time. So Jonathan Antoine, classically trained tenor, Britain's Got Talent finalist. He's been working with Diane Warren lately for his latest single. He's appearing on the show to chat with me all about the fantastic Grace by Jeff Buckley. Another episode not to be missed. I know how excited people are about this episode too. So two great episodes in July that people are going to get really geared up for. So there's Jonathan, there's Phil, there's loads coming up. There's some more guests that I'm excited to announce. But as you know, I like to keep my cards close to my chest till it's all said and done. But so much more to get excited about here on My Classic Album. So thank you so much to everyone who's listened over the last 50 episodes. Thank you so much to everyone that's listened today. Thank you to Ian for appearing on the show. Thank you to anyone who has ever appeared on the show in any capacity. It's just an absolute thrill. It's a joy to do this show. And here's to another 50 episodes and hopefully beyond as well. Thank you very much for joining me today for 50 episodes of My Classic Album. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Me and Jonathan Antoine will be here talking about Grace. Thank you very much. Cheers.